near 40. Right now it's 36 degrees in Boston, 35 in Chatham. It's 9:06.
Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight we'll hear university professor and professor of literature and religion, Jeffrey Hill, on Courage in Shakespeare. Professor Hill's lecture is one of a series on the subject of courage presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Professor Hill is also a prize-winning poet. We'll follow Professor Hill's comments with a conversation with Professor Leroy Rauner, the director of the Institute of Philosophy and Religion. We'll talk with Professor Rauner about why he chose to put together a series of lectures on the theme of courage. In the first part of tonight's program, Professor Hill begins his lecture by discussing some of the probable influences on Shakespeare's understanding of courage. He puts particular emphasis on the tension between competing ideas of what is right and what is good that are found in two Italian sources of Shakespeare's time, Baldassare Castiglione's The Courtier and Niccolò Machiavelli's The Prince. Here now is Professor Jeffrey Hill on Courage in Shakespeare.
Taken at the conceptual level, courage in Shakespeare is essentially what it is in the major English writings of the preceding generation. For instance, Sir Thomas Eliot's the book named The Governor, first published in 1531, and Sir Thomas Hoby's translation of Baldassare Castiglione's Libro del Cortigiano, the Book of the Courtier, which had first appeared in the original Italian in 1528, 3 years prior to Eliot's Governor. Throughout Shakespeare's dramatic writings, the word courage occurs some 70 times, courageous 10 times, courageously twice. Those occasions, and here I have Shakespeare most immediately in mind, in which, though the word itself is not used, the principle or ethos of courage is manifestly present, must be virtually beyond computation, at least with the Luddite mechanisms employed by the electronically challenged minority to which I belong. In Shakespeare, the word courage occurs most thickly in the English histories. After that come the major tragedies, but the comedies and late romances are also represented. Indeed, to revert for a moment to the idea or ideal of courage, with or without the sanction of the word itself, I would suggest that it is an eminent distinction in the major comedies and the romances of Shakespeare, and is particularly associated with the patience and the resourcefulness of women. Viola in Twelfth Night, Rosalind in As You Like It, Helena in All's Well That Ends Well, Imogen in Cymbeline, Marina in Pericles, these are women of courage whose names spring immediately to mind. In attributing qualities of courage not only to young unmarried women, but also to matrons and the middle-aged, Hermione and Paulina in The Winter's Tale, Queen Catherine in Henry VIII, Shakespeare gives his own impresa to a style of psychological and moral address already well established and which he could have encountered. There is little or no direct evidence that he did in Hoby's translation of the Castiglione, Hoby's Book of the Courtier. The first thing we notice when we collate Hoby's version with Castiglione's text is that Sir Thomas Hoby employs the word courage to represent a variety of Italian words and phrases. At times, it stands in place of the humanist keyword magnanimità, as when Hobie writes, stoutness of courage. Magnanimità warrants an editorial footnote in my edition of the text. Stoutness of courage, magnanimity in the Aristotelian sense of the entire greatness of life. So, Hobie employs the phrase noble courage to translate magnanimità. He employs the phrase very courage to render la vera magnanimità, and so on. The great Protestant educator Sir John Cheke, tutor to the young Prince Edward, later Edward VI, provided a brief letter to go with the prefatory matter in Hobie's Book of the Courtier. It's dated 16th of July, 1557, and is addressed to his loving friend, Master Thomas Hobie, and stands in the text where testimonies of commendation are generally placed. But the letter is as much mild reproach as it is praise. It's clear that Cheke would have preferred Hobie not to use words from other European languages and to use instead, as he says, our own tongue, written clean and pure, unmixed and unmangled with borrowing of other tongues. It's a happy irony that Shakespeare, who from Cheke's point of view, his purist standpoint, would be seen as one of the arch adulterators of our tongue, the multitudinous seas incarnadine, could also create his great effects with English written clean and pure. Regarded from Cheke's narrow angle of vision, that distrust of any foreign words brought into English, the word courage itself would have to be seen as borrowed from another tongue, even though the primary senses had been established in England by the end of the 14th century. The OED cites this word courage as a common Romanic word answering to a Latin type, coraticum, from cor, heart. Its basic etymology is the heart as the seat of feeling, the heart as the seat of thought, spirit, mind, disposition, nature. That sense was already established in England around 1300. And the OED asks us to consider the sense of the phrase to tell all one's heart, to tell all one's heart, which is a parallel sense to speak one's mind, to tell all one's heart or to speak one's mind. The modern sense, which is that quality of mind which shows itself in facing danger without fear, was established by the third quarter of the 14th century. To Hobie's Castiglione translation, the Oxford English Dictionary gives the first recorded citation of courage as used as synecdoche, taking the part for the whole, the prowess of those divine courage or courages, meaning, in this sense, the prowess of those persons of divine courage. At the heart of Castiglione's ideal of the animo generoso stands the imperative of self-knowledge. In Hobie's mid-16th century English, therefore a fond person, he means a fool, therefore a fool cannot be said to be stout-hearted, but very courage, vera magnanimità, indeed cometh of a proper advisement, una propria deliberazione, and a determined will so to do. Now this is the very courage I suggest of Helena in All's Well That Ends Well, of Viola in Twelfth Night, of Rosalind in As You Like It, of Imogen in Cymbeline, of Marina in Pericles, of Hermione and Paulina in The Winter's Tale, and of Queen Catherine in Henry VIII. Courage without self-knowledge is obstinacy. Courage without self-knowledge is obstinacy, as it is with Coriolanus in Shakespeare's play of that name. Now, there are numerous forms of courage that Sir Thomas Eliot, in the book to which I've already referred, the book named The Governor, there are numerous forms of courage that Sir Thomas Eliot qualifies by either a verb in the infinitive or an adjective preceding or following. Let me give you some examples. These are all examples of the use of the word courage in Eliot. Gentle courage, courage to study, martial courage, valiant courage, wanton courage, noble courage, courage invincible, fury or rage which they call courage, valiant and fierce courage, desperate courage, virtuous courage, courage and appetite, invincible courage, excellent courage and virtue, the stubborn courage of an obstinate servant, vile courage, the courage of all men inclined to virtue. Now, looking at Shakespeare's play in relation to that list, I would say that Hector in Troilus and Cressida represents gentle courage, and Troilus at the end of that same play manifests desperate courage. Richard III, in his last scene, fighting to the death against his victorious opponent, is desperate courage also. Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, I suggest, represent what Eliot calls vile courage. But stick your courage to the, but hold your courage to the sticking place, and we'll not fail, she says. Well, courage there is quite clearly, I think, not magnanimity. It's somewhere between desperate and vile courage. Now, there are plays by Shakespeare of which it is possible to say he wrote this with such and such a volume open on his desk. For the English history plays, one can say that it was Holinshed's Chronicle. With Coriolanus and other of the Roman plays, one can say it's Thomas North's English translation of Plutarch. Now, with the two works so far considered, Castiglione, translated by Hobie, and Sir Thomas Eliot's book named The Governor, I can make no such obvious and well-founded claim. I can say no more than that each of these two books modifies and enlarges the expository and debating language of their time, the language that Shakespeare directly inherited. Each is a book of polity, having to do with the training of princes and their chief magistrates, who are the governors of Eliot's title. In his imaginative makeup, Shakespeare was a populist and an elitist. He was a Christian Stoic and an opportunist. And I deduce that the intellectual elitist opportunist energies of works such as Eliot's Governor and Hobie's Castiglione would have fed directly or indirectly into Shakespeare's appetite for writing plays. In the fourth book of The Courtier, in its English translation, we read, "He that can command is always obeyed, and to command is evermore the principal office of princes, which notwithstanding ought many times also to see where their eyes and to be present at the deed doing." In short, a prince is right to delegate, but needs to get his hands dirty from time to time. It takes only a small redistribution of emphasis, and you have Machiavelli's Il Principe, though one adds that Castiglione does not make the same kind of recommendation for action as his Florentine contemporary. Castiglione's test word is magnanimità, Machiavelli's Czech word is virtue. It is not that Castiglione scorns virtue, but that he distrusts the use of that word in certain political contexts. Now, Shakespeare's political characterization seemed to me to inhabit a middle ground between magnanimità and virtue. The Prince Hal of Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, who becomes King Henry V in Shakespeare's brilliant, cold pageant play of that name, is a glittering instance of this. He undertakes war with France from a standpoint of manifest cynicism, following the deathbed precepts of his desperately cynical father. Therefore, my Harry, be it thy course to busy giddy minds with foreign quarrels, preempt domestic revolution and trouble by turning everybody's attention to the kind of plunder they can get in a foreign war. And yet, both before and after the Battle of Agincourt, he is portrayed by Shakespeare as a figure of magnanimity, of the animo generoso. In his exchanges of words with the common soldiers of his own army, and in the marriage negotiations with his prospective in-laws, the royal family of defeated France. Are we intended to draw up a trim ledger here, seeing how or if we can balance out virtue with or against magnanimità? I think not. Shakespeare's strongest grasp of human creatures is revealed in the way his imagination seizes on the ambiguities in their individual natures or in their circumstances. These are not terms which I would apply to either Castiglione or Machiavelli or Eliot. Castiglione and Machiavelli are ironists, by which I mean that they automatically assume the latent inveterate nature of human fallibility in their presentations of ideal perfection. Of course, they work from opposite ends of the ethical spectrum, Castiglione purporting to think the best, Machiavelli purporting to think the worst of human motives. Sir Thomas Eliot was a survivor in the court of King Henry VIII, the protege of successively Cardinal Wolsey, Thomas Cromwell, and Sir Thomas More. Wolsey died disgraced. Cromwell and More were beheaded. Eliot died in his bed. He must have been an ironist, too. In the closing pages of The Courtier, one of the participants in the conversazione celebrates love as, "Thou the most sweet bond of the world, a mean betwixt heavenly and earthly things, with a bountiful temper bendest the high virtues to the government of the lower, and turning back the minds of mortal men to their beginning, couplest them with it." Now, Hobie's English translation introduces an unwitting ambiguity in one phrase. Bendest the high virtues to the government of the lower. Hobie's English translation, spiked on the syntactical ambiguity of the possessive of to and of, might as well be saying that love causes the higher virtues to be governed by the baser emotions. Now, we all know this to be a fact of life. There are several passages in The Courtier which acknowledge that there is in our mind a variance between reason and greedy desire, and that we know also that Platonic reverence and awe can, with fatal ease, be diverted, debauched into sensual love. But these acknowledgments do not alter the fact that Hobie's "bendest the high virtues to the government of the lower" is an obtrusive accidental of syntax. In Othello, more terribly, more benightedly than in any other of Shakespeare's plays, we witness the high virtues bent by the agency of Iago to the government of, that is to be governed by, the lower, indeed the lowest, the basest instincts and appetites. One frequently hears characters such as Iago referred to as Machiavellian, but they are not so really. The men of devilish cunning and adamantine malign will are types that the dramatists of Shakespeare's day took more from the anti-Machiavellian propagandists, the hostile parodists of Machiavelli, than from the man himself. Although Il Principe, first printed in Rome in 1532, with the sanction and favor of the Pope, remained publicly untranslated into English for more than a century, the first printed translation of Il Principe was in 1640, on the threshold of the English Civil War. Nonetheless, Il Principe was being read in England by aristocrats such as Lord Morley and such preeminent statesmen as Thomas Cromwell very soon after it had appeared from the presses in Italy. Shakespeare's Henry IV and Henry V, and perhaps the Duke in Measure for Measure, negotiate more closely and coolly as students of the small Italian treatise. Having said that, I acknowledge that Machiavelli did something to the concept of virtue in 1532 that differentiated, even alienated it, from the resonances given it by Castiglione 4 years earlier in 1528. In Castiglione, virtù is one of the types of courage which can be interpreted as the will and capacity to hold fast to le virtù superne. Now, if you detect a tautology here, it's not, I think, accidental, because virtù for Castiglione is the capacity to act virtuously. It is virtue in action, acting with courage, having that courage of spirit which we seek to have in our courtier, as Hobbes renders it. In Machiavelli, and here I draw heavily on L.A. Bird's splendid 1891 edition of Il Principe, the term is part of a collocation, per fortuna o per virtù, which appears repeatedly in Machiavelli's writings, not only in Il Principe, but in the Discorsi also. Bird observes that for Machiavelli, virtù corresponds in some degree to the French habileté, any man who by his abilities, tact, and dexterous management of men and things attains his ends, is said to possess virtù. The character of the means he employs or the object he attains are matters of indifference. Now, in the Discorsi, virtue in one place signifies the ability of the legislator. In another place, it is applied to the achievements of Hannibal, whom Machiavelli nonetheless calls empio, pitiless, and crudele, cruel as a tyrant is cruel. Now, among the Shakespearean characters who exemplify virtù in the sense of habileté, tact and dexterous management, I would give a conspicuous place to Vincentio, Duke of Vienna, in Measure for Measure. Vincentio, Duke of Vienna, who, sickened by the city's corruption, which in office he has failed to curb, pretends to leave on an urgent diplomatic mission, handing the reins of government to his sanctimonious deputy, Angelo. The Duke does not, in fact, leave the city, but disguised as a friar, stays to keep an eye on governor and governed. His words at close Act 1, Scene 3, "Hence we shall see, if power change purpose, what our seemers be," anticipate his quasi-choric conclusion to Act 3. Having rapidly discovered the attractions of lust, Angelo has decreed that unless Isabella has sex with him, her brother Claudio will be put to death. He intends to put him to death anyway. The Duke discovers Angelo's intention and says at the end of his chorus-like soliloquy, "Craft against vice I must apply. With Angelo tonight shall lie his old betrothed, but despised. So disguised shall by the disguised pay with falsehood, false exacting, and perform an old contracting." Duke Vincentio, that is to say, has encouraged a forlorn lady, whom Angelo had jilted, to take Isabella's place in Angelo's bed. Vincentio's counterplot succeeds, not quite as Machiavelli prescribes, per fortuna o per virtù, but rather per fortuna e per virtù. Angelo is pardoned and marries the jilted lady. Claudio is saved. The Duke weds Isabella. The clue to this type of Shakespearean comedy is emblematical, as I see it, in the change of the Italian O to A, from the or to the and. Commentators like to stress the Christian nature of this play. "Judge not that ye be not judged, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured unto you again." Matthew 7:1 in the Geneva Bible version of 1560. Commentators also see it as a play about the nature of equity, which was on people's minds then, partly because Catholic recusants and Calvinist separatists both appealed to it, seeking to mitigate the punitive inflexibility of the Church of England in the matter of obligatory church attendance. Those who appeal to the Sermon on the Mount and those who appeal to the Court of Star Chamber, where equity suits were heard, unite in their conclusion that Measure for Measure shows a sense of dissatisfaction with its own dramatic mode, concentrated in its notoriously troublesome final scene, and a predominant harshness of tone, a savagery even in its clowning. I've elsewhere committed thoughts to print on this perplexity, and I beg you to permit me to quote myself on it. As with the Gospels, which it is allowed to resemble, in Measure for Measure, moral uplift is not the issue. Scrupulosity, diffidence, shrill spirituality, conviction, free expression come off as poorly as deceit or lust. The ethical motif is, so we may hazard, opportunism, redemptive and redeemed, case hardened on case law, casuist's own redemption, the general temper, a caustic equity. Another illustration of this theme, courage in Shakespeare, moves us on a few years from Measure for Measure in Shakespeare's chronology of work to 1608, to the writing and staging of that violently enigmatic, expansively cryptic study of misconceived, misguided, misanthropic, inordinate courage, the tragedy of Coriolanus. There's no arguing against the facts of the matter. Coriolanus displays the unconquered prowess in arms that is Castiglione's princely ideal. In fact, Sir Thomas Eliot cites Coriolanus in Book 3, Chapter 17 of the book named The Governor. He cites him simply as an exemplar of valiant acts and of a becoming modesty in victory. Eliot, however, truncates a fable which originates with Dionysus of Halicarnassus, with Livy and Plutarch. Now, in all three of these authorities, Coriolanus's early and triumphal prowess in arms is marred by a singular failure to understand himself, a failure that terminates in his becoming a traitor to his city, Rome, and to his own cult of courage and fortitude. As Sir Thomas Eliot notes in the heading and opening sentence to Book 3, Chapter 14 of The Governor, "Of magnanimity, which may be named valiant courage, of magnanimity, which may be named valiant courage." Magnanimity is a virtue much commendable, and also expedient to be in a governor, and is, as I have said, a companion of fortitude. Note particularly that Eliot says commendable and also expedient. Now, Coriolanus is prowess without magnanimity, as Othello is magnanimity without discretion. Let me just say that again. Coriolanus is prowess without magnanimity, as Othello is magnanimity without discretion. As I said, note particularly that Eliot says commendable and also expedient. Now, the major sense of that second term, expedient, established by 1398, was conducive to advantage in general or to a definite purpose, fit, proper, or suitable to the circumstances of the case. The OED does not recognize the depreciative sense, useful or politic, as opposed to just or right, any earlier than 1774. One enters a caveat here, of course, the common thoughts and common practices which eventually bring about a shift of meaning probably almost certainly appear in human minds and motives for generations before official etymology catches up with them and confirms the shift. The gravitational pull of original sin ensures that a preferring of the useful or politic over the just and the right remains a staple of human conduct across the centuries. There is a persistent credibility gap, so to speak, between official descriptive language and human behavior. And Shakespeare's contemporary Francis Bacon, in a strikingly sober appraisal, commended Machiavelli for cogently and succinctly drawing attention to this gap between what men ought to do and what they do in fact. This is the area in which I find Shakespeare most characteristically activates his imagination. The age in which he worked was rich in volumes of official descriptive language, the courtesy books, the books teaching the elements of rhetoric, the official histories such as Polydore Virgil's Anglica Historia, Moore's History of Richard III, Holinshed's Chronicles and Grafton's Chronicle at Large, and the Greek and Roman histories that were like oblique commentaries on English politics and politicking, or at least were read as such. Sir Thomas North's Plutarch, Suetonius's History of the Twelve Caesars, translated by Philemon Holland, 1606. Shakespeare's dramatic genius is to take the domain of maxim and axiom, of motto, emblem, and moral fable, and let us in this particular case relate these all to the concept of courage. Shakespeare's dramatic genius is to take the domain of maxim and axiom, of motto, emblem, and moral fable, as they stand in relation to courage, and refract it through the medium of human behavioral heterogeneity. And one of my closing gestures in a lecture entitled Courage in Shakespeare would be to point to the linguistic prowess, the semantic magnanimity, the virtu, with which genius in Shakespeare enacts itself in the arena of words and deeds. I find myself having to return to a basic question regarding harmony or disharmony between intention and expectation in life and in art. In a work of the high order of Coriolanus, for example, one senses the author's imagination as a kind of fulcrum, which enables him to get a purchase on two disparate kinds of massive inert weight. There is the inertia of the story itself, the energy needed simply to get the action started and off the ground. I would say that the wretchedly familiar experience that we all have of writer's block is intimately connected with this manner of purchase. Of course, many writers experience such a block. The inert weight has got to be moved the first few inches, so to speak, and this can prove intolerably difficult. The other kind of inert mass is the expectation or the taste, the demand for relevance and accessibility in whatever period the author is writing. the desire to, in our case, in our century, our desire, I'd say, above all, to smear our disgusting empathy over one or other character instead of giving humble attention to the entirety of the play's discourse. The voice of Shakespeare is the play in its entirety, the play itself. And what I say about the fulcrum and the inert mass is a metaphor that applies as well to King Lear or The Tempest or Troilus and Cressida or Timon of Athens or Richard II as it does to Coriolanus. Shakespeare never ceases to be aware of what is demanded of him, both justly and unjustly. But Coriolanus stands a little apart from those other writings in its unremitting concentration on the death struggle between actor and audience, between freedom and demand, between being and appearance of being. I feel that to some extent the tragic circumstances of the other great tragedies involve a metaphysics of the spirit. Indeed, Antonin Cleopatra glories in this fact. The glory is in the language of the last act. But Coriolanus is without spirit, as we are disposed to consider the human spirit in those other plays. It lacks the metaphysical dimension. I state that not as a complaint, but as a fact. The integrity of the play is all the more vindicated by our discovery of a blank area where we expect to find a meaningful moral structure. And I would say in conclusion that Shakespeare's courage as an author, as a handler of language and concept, is the courage of allowing those blank areas to exist, even when the audience is demanding a meaningful moral structure. Thank you.
That was University Professor and Professor of Literature and Religion Jeffrey Hill on courage in Shakespeare. Following his talk, Professor Hill responded to questions from the audience. One person remarked that Professor Hill's discussion of courage struck him as being much the same as integrity. Yet having the integrity, or the courage, to be true to yourself, as for example Romeo and Juliet are true to themselves, could end up being destructive.
The source of Shakespeare's play was a narrative poem, The Tragical History of Romeo and Juliet, by a little-known poet called Arthur Brooke. And it was a poem entirely censorious. It treated the two lovers as a most dreadful example of disobedience. This is what happens when you disobey your parents. And incidentally, since Brooke was a Protestant, of course, he also said, this is what happens to you when you trust friars. And Brooke uses the word thrall in a negative sense, being trapped, being imprisoned, being as it were, in thrall, as if one were in chains or bonds. It seems to me, in a way, as if Shakespeare is changing the idea of enthrallment even as he writes. That is to say that, to revert to your point, which I think was a very good one, and I would certainly be very happy with this word integrity, there is a power in mutual love which can bring disaster, but which nonetheless transcends in one dimension the tragedy that's recurring in the other dimension. That is to say, from a rather mean and grudging poem by Brooke, Shakespeare writes a play of, as a great imaginative generosity. Shakespeare's plays are, so to speak, two-dimensional. There is the action and there is the language, and the language is doing far more than merely telling us, you know, what is going on. The language all the time is acting as a chorus.
Another questioner asked, what was Shakespeare's vision of human faith? And what courage is necessary to realize that vision?
I think you have to go play by play, and I think his vision of human courage changes quite frequently from play to play. His vision of human life and of human courage is definitely not the same in Measure for Measure, Troilus and Cressida, and possibly All's Well That Ends Well as it is in The Winter's Tale and The Tempest. It is a much more... I mean, Shakespeare, I think, is never cynical. He presents... He's full of cynical characters, but he's not himself cynical. He is sometimes skeptical. But the vision, his vision of human nature, of human fortune and misfortune and human life, is much grimmer in Measure for Measure and certainly in Troilus and Cressida, than it is in those great late romances. So Shakespeare's view of human courage, human destiny, is not a constant. I mean, it is not constant from throughout his life. He clearly changes his mind quite, I won't say drastically, but changes his mind significantly in the course of his working career on these very questions.
Another questioner asked, where Shakespeare stood at the end of his career? What was his idea of courage by the time he came to The Tempest?
Did he know it? You know, he may not have intended The Tempest to be his last statement, you see. That's the difficulty. We treat it, I mean, obviously now, with benefit of hindsight, so to speak, we treat it as that. And it certainly makes itself amenable to be treated like that. I think his overall vision, if one can be so rash as to say, is that something like magnanimity is what we most need, but that which we very rarely get. I mean, his whole attitude to and response to Christianity is very difficult to weigh up. To what extent are those? I mean, in what sense, if at all, is say, The Tempest really a Christian play? And yet, I could imagine Shakespeare, the man, being a perfectly kind of Sunday by Sunday conformer at the Church of England. Certainly his Church of England is not the very blood and bone of his being and of his work as it is, say, for John Donne or George Herbert. I think of The World of Castiglione, which was certainly taken over, absorbed, and used by his contemporaries, filtered through to him in some way. And I do get the inference from his work that he puts a very high premium on magnanimity. But, as I said, sees the plethora of occasions when it is useless, when it simply does not work.
Another question concerned the bad end that characters who act with courage seem to come to in Shakespeare's tragedies. Was this a sense of Christian divine judgment at work?
Well, actually, of course, Macbeth, now I think of it, Macbeth is the nearest to being a Christian play. You do get the sense strongly in Macbeth that there is hell and judgment awaiting. What is his phrase? This dead butcher and his fiend-like queen. Not only that, but the very carefully placed allusions to Edward the Confessor, the touching for the king's evil, and so on. I think you could certainly take Macbeth in Christian terms. You can't take King Lear. There isn't the same sense of lifting up to judgment in Shakespeare, or that insistence on some beneficent, overarching Christian sensibility that Spenser is so very keen to get into The Faery Queen.
That was University Professor and Professor of Literature and Religion Jeffrey Hill, answering questions about his talk, Courage in Shakespeare. Following Professor Hill's talk, I met with Leroy Rauner, the director of the Institute of Philosophy and Religion. The Institute sponsors this year's series of talks on the relationship of courage to philosophy and religion. Professor Rauner, why choose a topic such as courage to relate to philosophy and religion? How does that relate?
Well, we started with straight academic philosophy of religion topics, myth, symbol, and reality. And then I became concerned with the kinds of human issues that philosophers and theologians used to talk about and don't talk about very much anymore. And courage was one of those. We've done programs on the longing for home and happiness and friendship. My particular interest in courage came from reading Paul Tillich's The Courage to Be, where he used that idea as a way of interpreting faith, that faith is really the courage to affirm oneself in relation to something transcendent. So I was fascinated to explore that, as well as the ways in which that related to, you know, courage is valor, that sort of thing.
Courage is something that you hear related to the existentialists,
mm-hmm.
you know, the courage to exist.
Yes. Again, I was influenced by Tillich because he was a teacher of mine. And for him, it was an act of courage to get out of bed in the morning. I don't mean just for him personally, but that we don't realize the extent to which if we calculated all the odds, we probably wouldn't get out of bed. We'd say, you know, this is not likely to work. And that there is something very basic. He read it through existentialist eyes, very basic about a fundamental human anxiety, which is not doesn't have a particular object, but is brought on by the fact that we're going to die.
And it is courage in the face of man's
yes.
fate
yeah.
that is worth examining
mm-hmm.
and using as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
How does one tell the kind of courage we all hope to have from false courage?
That's a very interesting, important, and difficult question because a lot of people can have false courage, bravado. Who are we to say that that's not being brave? There's several marks. One is personal integrity, if you get a sense that that's what's happening for an individual. Generosity, willingness to suffer. If one saw someone or felt in oneself that these were things that you could summon up in the face of some kind of adversity, those would be authentic marks of genuine courage, the kind of courage that we would like to see.
Did your series at any point ask the question, courage in the service of what?
Yes. The more religiously oriented lectures, some of them were just philosophical analyses of the idea, but the religious ones were talking about courage in the service of God. And that wasn't always at the forefront. And the Institute is not a denominationally oriented thing. We are essentially a conversation about important human issues that we all share at the point where philosophy and religion meet.
You've been pursuing this at the Institute for Philosophy and Religion with an annual series of lectures and books drawn from that for over 20 years
mm-hmm.
now. What conclusions would you reach looking back over the 20, 21 years that you've been doing this? What stands out in your mind about what has come out of this effort?
What I think is important is the fact that it's a conversation rather than a research program. Universities are now multiversities and have no common cake of custom, as the anthropologists used to call it. The same is true of the national culture. We don't have a civil religion anymore that binds us together. And I'm persuaded that there's no point in trying to go back to any old orthodoxy, and that the way you build some new sense of community is through conversation. And I think this reflection on basic issues like courage and home and friendship and that sort of thing has been important to do. I don't think it hasn't changed the world, but it's had value for the people who participated in it.
And if community is conversation, then the conversation must continue.
Yeah, yeah.
There's never really a conclusion.
Mm-hmm. And to that extent, when I write the introductions to these volumes, I always point out ways in which different authors are in agreement, ways in which they fundamentally disappear, and what some of the issues are left to ponder. But anyone who says, you know, have you produced a philosophy of courage in the course of this year's program, gets a disappointing no as a response. We're still talking about it.
Well, on that note, I'll thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. This evening, Courage in Shakespeare. We've just been talking with Leroy Rauner, director of Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Director Rauner chose the topic of how courage fits into philosophy and religion and put together the center's series of lectures that explores that question. Earlier, we heard one of those talks, Courage in Shakespeare, given by university professor and professor of literature and religion, Jeffrey Hill. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. And visit our website at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda, Michael Garth, Ben Walker, and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Stay tuned for BBC Assignment coming up at 10 o'clock after the news, and then at 10:30, it's EuroQuest. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New Market Films, presenting Memento, one of this year's Sunday.